My subject is market anarchy, and there are two reasons one might reject the idea of market anarchy. One was that you believed in markets but didn't like the idea of anarchy, and the other is that you believed in anarchy but didn't like markets. Anybody know what to do about this silly thing? Is that all right? I don't really need a microphone for people to hear me given the size of this room. I have a very loud voice. So I thought I would talk about both of those problems before I went into describing. First, I have to figure out how this machine. There we are. Before I went into describing how I would imagine a society which had private property and markets but did not have any government would work. So there are two problems that I want to raise, one of them for believers in markets and one of them for believers in anarchy. And the problem for believers in the free market, who generally, I'm really thinking of people in the classical liberal tradition, and they accept the idea of a minimal state which provides police, courts, and laws, and generally national defense, and it provides police, courts, and laws as the framework for the market. And then in that view of the world, the market within that framework does everything you want it to do. The problem with that is that if the government is not competent to build cars, why do you expect it to be competent to make laws? For the anarchists who don't believe in capitalism, how do they solve the coordination problem? In order for any complicated society to work, you have to have some way of coordinating very large numbers of people so that if I want to make a pencil, somebody is cutting the wood, and if he wants to cut wood, somebody is making the chainsaws, and if he wants to make the chainsaws, somebody is producing steel and copper and gasoline and all sorts of other things, and somehow all of those people, and if you trace the chain all the way back, you can see it's generally millions of people, have to coordinate their activities. There has to be some way in which enough iron ore is dug and enough coal is dug to make enough iron, to make enough steel, to make enough chainsaws, to cut enough trees, to make enough pencils, plus all of the other things those resources are being used to do. And the question is, in a society which does not have private property or trade, how do you do it? The other alternative method is central control, and that doesn't work, as we've had demonstrated a number of times, most dramatically by the Soviet Union. All right, now let me switch, let me go into more detail on the minarchist version of that, that is the classical liberal position. The minarchist problem, as I already suggested, if governments are bad at producing things, if they control food production, we have famines. If they produce automobiles, cars are likely to be expensive and break down a lot. Therefore, the classical liberal says we should produce food and cars on the market. What about law? How does it get produced? The production of law is not a trivial problem. I don't know if any of you have actually studied law in law school, but I have not been to law school as a student, but I spent many years in law schools as a professor. Teaching economic analysis of law and a variety of other things. And it turns out law is actually quite a hard problem, that there are a lot of things which, if you look at them as an economist, seem obvious. And then you look at them as a law professor and say, wait a minute, he says he owns this land. What does that mean? Does that mean he can prohibit airplanes from flying over it? Does that mean he can prohibit people from mining underneath it? Does that mean he can prohibit his neighbor from digging a hole on the boundary that his house is going to slide into? There turns out that a legal code is actually quite a complicated produced object. If governments control the production of law, we would expect to get bad law, just as happens when governments produce other things. And my answer is to find a way of producing law on the market the way we produce cars and pencils and food. Right? For the left anarchists, centralized authority may work for a small group, but it doesn't scale, as was demonstrated fairly dramatically, as I said before, by the Soviet Union, but there are lots of other examples. The decentralized solution does work, and the decentralized solution to the coordination problem consists of breaking the problem down into tiny pieces, giving each person control over one piece, and then somehow setting it up so that each person has about the right incentives to make the decisions for his piece that solve the problem for all of us. And the way that works in the decentralized system we're familiar with, which is private property and trade, is that prices are the signals. That if there isn't enough wood for things people want to use wood for, the price of wood goes up. That gives people an incentive to cut more trees and to plant more trees. If there isn't enough of something else, if there's too much of something, price goes down. You generally spend a semester or two of a price theory course understanding the details of how that works. But the general sketch, I think, is fairly clear. And that solution works, and it works. It not only scales up, as centralized authority doesn't, it scales up all the way to a global scale, because that happens to be the world we're living in. There is no central planner at the UN telling countries what to produce. Nonetheless, I can get Spanish wine and sausage in a US market. So somehow this decentralized system with nobody in charge manages to coordinate very large numbers of people. And the problem for the left anarchists is, how do you do the equivalent without property and trade? I'm not going to be discussing that more, because this talk is more nearly directed at people who share my general preference for the market, but some of whom are not taking it quite as far as they should. But I wanted to raise that point, especially because I'm in Spain, which has, in fact, a real tradition in its history of left anarchy. So how would market anarchy work? We start out with private firms which sell the service of protecting their customers' rights and settling their disputes. Each individual is the customer of such a firm, just as individual drivers at present are customers of insurance companies. And then the obvious problem, the reason that everybody from Ayn Rand on says this can't possibly work, is how do we handle conflict between customers of two different firms? So I believe that this nice gentleman stole my television set. He denies it. He has a nice television set, but a friend of his gave it to him, and he, none of my business who the friend is. So my firm, after looking at the video taken in my living room that showed him walking out of my door with my television set, my firm asks him to return the television set. He says no. And my firm says, well, in that case, three big strong men are going to show up at your front door tomorrow morning to retrieve the television set. And he says, well, that's very nice, but I too have a rights enforcement agency. And I will call them, and if three big bullies come to my front door to take my television set, they will send four defenders of my rights to protect me. So that's the obvious problem, and the question is, how do we deal with it? It sounds like the result is set up for violent conflict between the two agencies. And the reason it doesn't happen is that violence is bad business. That if we settle conflicts by violence, we are going to have to pay our workers hazard pay for the risk that they might get shot when they are retrieving the television set or when they're preventing the television set from being retrieved. Furthermore, our customers are going to have to worry about having their front yard turned into a free fire zone while their agency fights my agency. And furthermore, we will be in a world where you cannot predict what things are or are not yours or what will happen. And it's very hard to live in a world where property rights are very insecure. So that would not be a very good way of providing our customers with the product they want. It's cheaper for both firms to agree in advanced arbitration, to agree on a private court, and both firms agree that it will accept its judgment about who the television set belongs to, that when the television set, when the court correctly reports that this gentleman has my television set, he will let me take it back and will pay a little bit of damages for the time and trouble we had. But if the court made a mistake and reported that it was really his television set, I would pay him some damages for having bothered him. All right? And then the obvious question that you ought to be asking is, well, this is an agreement between the two firms, but what enforces it? Because after all, this is a world with no government. So the fact that the two firms have signed a contract agreeing to arbitration doesn't mean that they can force each other to obey the contract. And the answer is that what enforces that contract is what's sometimes referred to as the discipline of constant dealings, the fact that they are repeat players. If my firm doesn't accept the verdict when your firm wins the case, then yours won't accept it when I win, at which point we are now back to fighting each other, and our customers will switch to firms that have a more sensible policy for dealing with conflict. So the basic argument is that it is in the interest of the rights enforcement agencies to agree in advance on private arbitration instead of violence. All right. Then the next question that ought to occur to you is, who makes the law that these disputes are being settled under? Who decides what kind of evidence it takes to prove that he stole a television set, what damages he owes, and so forth? And the answer is that the rules are the law is being produced on the market, because the legal rules the arbitration agency follows are part of the package that it's selling its customers. Its customers are the rights enforcement agencies. What do the rights enforcement agencies want? They want rules that will make people want to buy their services. So the arbitration agency is trying to figure out what law code will it can best sell, and the rights enforcement agencies are trying to figure out what law code they want to buy because they want to buy the law code that their customers will want so that they will have customers to pay their bills. Start out with the easy case. Suppose there is some change in the legal rules which benefits customers of both firms, benefits ex ante in advance. Obviously, once a dispute is happening, this gentleman may actually want very high standards of proof for treating television sets, but in advance, all of us are potential infringers and potential victims. So if there is a change, say, in the rules of evidence or in the procedures or anything else, that benefits customers of both firms, that's easy. The arbitration agency will realize that by making that change, it can make rights enforcement agencies more willing to buy its products. Slightly harder case is a change that one firm wants and the other firm doesn't want. So I've usually imagined this as considering that the issue is the death penalty, that customers of one firm want to make sure that if anybody kills them, he will hang. They either feel that that will satisfy themselves in the afterlife, or they feel that under that rule they won't get killed because nobody wants to hang. On the other hand, the customers of the other firm don't agree. They feel that they don't want to be responsible for hanging somebody even if he's killed them. Besides, courts might make mistakes and might hang an innocent man. And besides, what if they get angry and kill somebody? They don't want to hang either. So you can imagine a case where, on average, the customers of one agency are for the death penalty and the other agency against. And then the way I would imagine it happening is that the pro-death penalty agency does some market research, and they estimate as best they can how much more they could charge their customers if they could guarantee that there would be a death penalty in any conflict with customers of the other firm. The other firm makes a similar calculation, similar market research, to find out how much more they could charge their customers if they could guarantee that there wasn't a death penalty as between customers of these two firms. Whichever firm comes up with a higher number then makes a deal with the other firm, agrees to pay them something to agree to their preferred rule, or else they find other legal rules they disagree about, and trade off that we will go with you on this one and you will go with us on that one. So the result is that you have a market procedure which is going to tend to maximize the total benefit to the people the rules apply to. That is to say, if the value of having a particular rule to the people who want it is larger than the cost to the people who don't want it, you get the rule, otherwise not. And for any econ students in the audience, this gives us what economists would refer to as efficient law, economically efficient law. Economic efficiency is a rather imperfect measure of how well off people are. It consists of saying, if everybody affected by some change honestly said how much it was worth to him either to get it or to stop it, and we add up the people who want it as pluses and the people who want to stop it as minuses, if the sum is positive, we'll do it. So it's a way of saying we are maximizing total benefit summed over people as defined by what people would be willing to pay to get or prevent something. That's a very short statement of a very complicated subject. It is not a perfect measure of how good something is, but it may be the best measure available for economists to use, because what people value things at is observed in their actual behavior and what prices they're willing to pay or not willing to pay, whereas how happy people something makes people happens inside their heads, and it's hard to construct institutions that will measure it and respond to it. But in any case, the implication of this, now I should say, if there are any good economic students here, you will see that my statement that this gives you economically efficient law is a little bit too simple for reasons I'm not going to go into, but it's at least the right first approximation. One of the reasons I'll go into later. All right, let's compare this way of getting good law to democracy, which is the currently fashionable way. Voters have no incentive to be well informed. A rational voter realizes that his vote has, well, I'm in California, my vote has no chance at all of determining who is president, because any presidential election where there is any significant chance the Republican will carry California, he doesn't need it. But some people are in swing states, so there are probably people in the U.S. who have as much as one chance in 100,000 of affecting the outcome of a presidential election. And I don't know the details of Spanish politics, but I would be surprised if any of you had as much as, say, one chance in 10,000 of influencing some really important outcome in your political system. And we are not willing to bear very large costs for one chance in 10,000 or one chance in 100,000 of getting a result. Consequently, rational voters are ignorant. Rationally ignorant is the term in public choice theory. Now, some people are not ignorant because they think it's fun to look at politics, or because they like to argue with other people and to show off how well-informed they are. But nobody has a rational incentive to be well-informed in order to get the right guy elected. Furthermore, even if you did want to do that, it is very hard to get the relevant information. Now, it is true that in any election, about half the people know for sure that one candidate will be better for the country, and about half of them know for sure the other candidate will be better for the country. But in fact, none of them really know it for sure, any more than they know for sure many of the other things people are divided on. And they can't observe it. There's no way that I can compare the job Obama did being president from 2012 to 2016 with the job that McCain, who ran against him, would have done, because we only get one. And that's true quite generally. You can say, well, I don't like how things worked out under Obama, or I do like how things worked out under Obama. But you don't have the other side to compare it to. You don't have a way of knowing whether it would have been better or worse with the other candidate. Compare that to your situation on the market. On the market, I can compare one car to another. If I really care a lot, I can even rent one of the cars I'm thinking of buying for a little while and then rent the other one, or I can talk to my friends and see what their reports are. In the US, we have consumer reports, which measures stuff like this. So the things I'm choosing among are actually there to be looked at. And in the anarcho-capitalist system, in the market anarchist system, I can compare what quality of law and law enforcement my neighbor gets. He's a customer of a different agency than the quality that I get. When he had something happen, how fast did the private police show up? How easily was the dispute settled? So forth and so on. So furthermore, unlike the political situation, it pays me to get the information, because what determines the president I get is who everybody else votes for. What determines the car I get is who I vote for, which car I choose to buy. And similarly, in my system, what determines the law and law enforcement I get is which agency I choose to be a customer of. Now, of course, I don't have the option of having any law I like. It's got to be law that they can get an arbitration agency to offer and other agencies to agree to. So I am choosing from not a perfectly wide subset. I don't get the law which says that I'm always right and you're always wrong, because oddly enough, you won't agree to that. But I do have the opportunity to choose among some range, and it's in the interest of the people who are selling law to me to try to produce the law that I want. Next question for libertarians in the audience, who I guess in this country I can sensibly call liberals. In my country, however, the enemies of liberalism stole its name quite a long time ago. But so any liberals in the audience or any libertarians in the audience, that's why we took the name libertarian and we stole it from the left anarchists, who I should say stole it from the believers in free will. So this is a long chain of transfers of title to names. But the question then is market anarchy libertarian? Does it result in a set of laws of the sort that libertarians want? The logic of the situation implies, as I said at the previous slide, that you will tend to have the legal rules that maximize summed benefits summed over everybody affected, economically efficient law. Will that be law that respects liberty? The answer is maybe. If there are enough people who are willing to pay enough for oppressive law, the market will produce it. The market produces what customers want. So if you imagine a society where almost everybody believes that heroin use is a horrible thing, in that society, the opponents of heroin use will outbid the people who want to use it, and you will end up, at least in most of that society, with laws against heroin. There might be some areas where it went the other way if the drug addicts happen to be concentrated geographically, but roughly speaking, you'd get what I would regard as the wrong law, because in my view, what you put into your body is your choice, not anybody else's, and I regard the war on drugs as a fairly major mistake in the U.S. and other countries that have it, one that does a great deal of damage. That could be another long argument, but the point I'm making is only that the system I'm arguing for will, under some circumstances, make the wrong laws in terms of my principles. But of course, under the circumstances I've described, a democratic system certainly will make the wrong laws, since if almost everybody thinks heroin is bad, politicians will all unanimously think heroin is bad, whether they do or not. Even if they're using heroin, they'll think heroin is bad when they're giving speeches. So therefore, this is a case where my system doesn't guarantee liberty, but it does no worse than the alternative. And in more balanced situations, it will do better. On the other hand, on average, liberty is economically efficient. It's a very odd thing that there are, in a sense, two different arguments for the libertarian position. One of them is that it's morally right, that it's wrong to coerce people. And the other is that it works better, that it results in people living longer, happier lives, fewer people starving to death, and so forth. And by a curious coincidence, these two arguments reach the same conclusion. And I think there's a similar coincidence in other political movements, actually. As far as I know, there aren't any socialists who believe that socialism is just but doesn't work. Maybe there are. I haven't met them, at least. But in any case, it is the view of most classical liberals, most libertarians, that liberty works, that it is very rarely worth as much to me to violate your rights as it is to you not to have your rights violated. And if that's the case, then, since the market is giving things their highest value, the market will tend to make laws in which you can't violate my rights. Right? If you compare anarchy to government, the mistake that a lot of people make in arguing politics on any side is arguing about outcomes rather than mechanisms. That is to say, if somebody says we ought to have a government which helps poor people at the expense of rich people, the first question is not whether you like that or not, it's whether that's going to happen or not. Given a particular set of political institutions, what results will you get? And that's true for both sides. So that rather than assuming an outcome, what you want to do is ask what outcome will occur from the institutions you're arguing for, and then whether you like that. There's a whole body of economics called public choice theory, which tries to figure out what the implications of political institutions are, which tries to treat the political system the same way we treat the economic system, to say in each case, you've got a whole lot of individuals, each individual has his own objectives, individuals make the choices as a rule that achieve their objectives, apply that to politics, and you say, well, voters will not choose to spend lots of resources studying the issue. Apply that to other parts of politics, and you say concentrated interest groups will be more able to raise money to bribe politicians than dispersed interest groups, so you will tend to have legal decisions, political decisions, which transfer money from dispersed interest groups to concentrated, well-organized interest groups, and you can make a variety of other predictions. Again, for the economists in the room, the economics of foreign trade were worked out just about 200 years ago by David Ricardo. From that day to this, almost every country in the world has acted in a way that makes its inhabitants worse off, that is, put up trade barriers. And the reason for that is that a trade barrier transfers from a dispersed interest group, namely the consumers who have to pay higher prices, and the export industries that export less when we import less, and transfers it to the protected industry, and that therefore is politically profitable, although economically unprofitable. That's a very brief summary of another talk, which I'm not giving at the moment. But ask what laws you can expect to get from government. And we have some evidence from that by looking at what laws we do get from government, and we also have a reasonable theoretical structure in public choice theory. And the same thing is true of anarchy, that it would be cheating for me to say, I define my anarchy as a libertarian anarchy in which the laws are always libertarian laws, because that makes no sense unless I can prove that's what will actually happen. So I'm defining my anarchy as a particular set of institutions, and it's then up to me to show that they will produce libertarian results, that the claim that anarcho-capitalism is libertarian is a theorem to be proved, not a definition. Right. And I've really given the argument already, but I'll give it. Good argument can always be worth giving again, that the people who produce law have an incentive to produce good law. The people who enforce law have an incentive to do it well. Under government, neither is true. Just like the comparison between the market and government in producing cars and food. That I'm arguing that for essentially the same reasons, the market will do a better job of producing law. Now, there are problems with the system I've described. I spent quite a long time thinking about the problems, and to give you sort of advance notice, I am not claiming that my system would work under all imaginable circumstances. I am only claiming that it is a system which would work under some fairly plausible circumstances, and that if it did work, the results would be attractive. So let me list what I see as three problems. The first one is the problem of defending against foreign nations, something we normally have governments to do. The second is the risk of cartelization of the rights enforcement industry, the risk that the rights enforcement agencies might decide that reinventing government would make them richer. And the third is what I refer to as market failure on the market for law. And I will go into all three of those in a little more detail. Let me start with national defense, which I regard as perhaps the hardest problem. Again, for the economists in the audience, a public good does not mean a good produced by government. A public good is a good such that the producer can't control who gets it. So that the public good problem is that the normal way of getting goods produced is that the producer sells them to the people who want them. If you have a good, or if you produce it, other people will get it whether you like it or not, you don't have the option of charging them for it. And then the public good problem is how do you get such goods produced? And there are a variety of solutions. It might occur to you that a radio broadcast is a public good, and yet, oddly enough, radio broadcasts are privately produced. And the way that particular public good is produced is that some unknown genius thought up the idea of producing not one public good, but two. One public good with a positive cost of production and a positive value to the customers, and one public good with a negative cost of production and a negative value to the customers. The two public goods, of course, are the broadcast and the advertisement. An advertisement has a negative cost of production because somebody will pay the radio station or television station to put it on. So you produce both goods, you tie them tightly together, and you give away the bundle. And that was one solution, one real-world solution to a particular public good problem. There are a variety of other solutions to other public good problems. I don't know the customs in Spain, but in the U.S., it is customary when you take a cab to give the cab driver about another 10% or so beyond what you owe him. And there's a similar custom with regard to waiters in restaurants and some other contexts. You are very unlikely to take the same cab again, so it looks as though there's no reason to tip him. You might go to the same restaurant again, in which case you figure that if you tip him, he'll treat you better next time, but if you're traveling, you don't. Nonetheless, people do, in fact, tip. And the total amount of money given for tips, I calculated it a long time ago. I don't remember the number, but it's surely in the billions of dollars a year. And that's the case where you've got certain social pressures, sort of norms of how decent people behave, which result in people being willing to bear modest costs accordingly. Charity is another obvious way in which we produce public goods. And another way is tie-ins, indirect benefits. So for example, my webpage contains the full text of several of my books, the full text of most of my journal articles, a good deal of other stuff. I'm giving it away for free, but then I get invited to come places like Santiago de Compostela, where I get to meet interesting people, see a nice cathedral, somewhat under construction just at the moment, and in general, spend a couple of weeks traveling around Europe, largely at other people's expense. So I have a side benefit there, and that side benefit gives me an incentive to produce the public good of making my information freely available. I should say that one of the more interesting cases of this is how political action gets produced. That if you think of a Students for Liberty, or whatever their opposite numbers are on the left, well, producing liberty has really faced a very large public good problem, because if these nice people succeed in making Spain free, they're going to make it free not just for them, but for everybody in Spain. So why would anybody ever do that sort of thing? Or, of course, if people, socialists who want to make a socialist, the same argument applies. And the answer is that there is a tie-in benefit associated with political activity, and that is you're doing that activity along with other people who share your values and who will like and admire you for your contribution to the joint project. And if you're a guy, you might find a nice girl, and if you're a girl, you might find a nice guy, and even if you're not looking for a romantic partner, you might find interesting friends to, you know, have dinner with and have conversations with. So I think that that sort of political activity is largely driven by the side benefit of people associating. And that's why I like to say that, at least in the US, one of the things that impresses me about Students for Liberty is that they have a higher ratio of women to men than any other libertarian organization I've been associated with. Not as high as it should be. It's still, the women are still outnumbered, I'm afraid. From their standpoint, it's a target-rich environment. But nonetheless, it has done at least a little bit better. I've asked some of the people who run SFL in the US how they did it, and the only answer I got was they got the men to dress decently. I don't know if it's true, but that is really the answer I got. Anyway, so for a discussion of how national defense might be produced, my first book, I had a chapter called The Hard Problem, and the third edition of that book has the second edition you can read for free on my webpage. The third edition is $2.99 as a Kindle on Amazon. One of the nice things about self-publishing is you can make Kindles really cheap if you want people to read them. And both of those have discussions. I've got two different chapters discussing conjectural ways in which national defense might be provided in a free society, in an anarchist society. Cartelization problem. And the basic problem is that if there are only three rights enforcement agencies, they might decide that robbery is more profitable than business. They agree not to compete for customers. So now you're locked into whichever agency you were a customer of, and they can raise the price and you have nowhere to go. All right? Or they might join. They might turn themselves into a single thing and reinvent government. Right? So that's one danger. How likely is that to happen? And speaking as an economist, the answer is it depends on how many rights enforcement agencies there are. That if you look at other industries, if there are two or three firms in an industry and no government preventing a cartel, it's quite likely they will form a cartel. How many firms will there be? Well, as any economist could tell you, that depends on economies of scale. Economies of scale are ways in which the cost of producing something changes with the size of the firm. And the usual pattern for most industries is that as firms get bigger, first costs go down and then they go up again. They go down as you take advantage of physical economies of scale, of things like having to design the product once, however many copies you're making. And then they go up again as you run into organizational diseconomies, because as the firm gets bigger, there are more and more layers between the president and the factory floor, and that makes it harder and harder for the president to make sure that the people in the factory floor are doing what he wants instead of what they want. That's a very short description, but I think it roughly describes why the usual situation is that costs first fall and then rise. where that happens depends on the size of the market and on the nature of the firm. So in some cases, I wander around the old city of Santiago and I observe a very large number of restaurants. So it's pretty clear that a restaurant serving 1,000 people at a time would do a less good job at a higher price, would in some ways be inferior to the very nice restaurant that I had dinner at last night, which had a much smaller number of people. Well, I showed up just after 8 o'clock, so of course it was practically empty since this is Spain. But in any case, on the other hand, there may be other industries where you end up, Google, for example, seems to be pretty nearly a natural monopoly. You can use DuckDuckGo if you want, and I'm sure there are some other search engines, but it seems to have real advantages in scale. So if it turns out that the optimal size of the firm is 1/100 of the number of the size of the market, then we end up with a nice competitive market. If it turns out it's 1/3, then we're in trouble. Right. Market failure or the market for law. Let me start by telling you what I think market failure is. Market failure does not mean markets failing. Like many other cases, technical terms are not self-explanatory. The theory of relativity does not simply say everything is relative. The market failure, I think, means situations where individual rationality doesn't produce group rationality, where if each individual does the right thing for himself, people in general are worse off. And my standard example of this is to imagine that it's about 1,000 years ago. You are one of 10,000 men with spears standing in a line pointing them that way, because coming at you are another 10,000 men on horseback with spears. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say, if all of us stand and keep our spears planted, with luck we can break their charge, and some of us will die, but many of us will live. If we run, horses run faster than we can, so I should stand. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. If I run and they stand, I won't be one of the people killed when we stop the charge, and if we don't stop the charge, at least I'll be ahead of the rest. If I stand and they run, I am dead. Whatever the other people are going to do, since I'm, it's again a public good problem, since I'm in 1 in 10,000, one fewer spear isn't going to make the difference in the battle, so I should run. We all do the calculation, we all run, and most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. All right? That's a simple description of market failure, and you'll notice it's not happening on the market. That it's a pattern which exists on markets, it exists in politics, it exists on the battlefield, it exists in households. It's a very general issue. But in particular, unfortunately, I believe that you would have market failure on the market for law. Let me give the one obvious example. If my firm and your firm agree that I can sue you for polluting my air, if they negotiate whether to agree that I can sue you for polluting my air, my firm will take account of costs and benefits to me. Your firm will take account of costs and benefits to you. But if I can sue you for polluting my air, you'll do less of it, and that will benefit people downwind who are customers of yet another firm. Their benefit is going to be left out of the calculation. So that means that my firm and your firm might agree that I can't sue you for pollution, that the costs to us of organizing that particular kind of lawsuit are higher than the benefits of less pollution, even if the net effect is positive if we allow for the people who are customers of other firms. So that's a general problem. And the general problem is if the legal rule between A and B produces substantial costs or benefits for C, then the market may fail to produce economically efficient law. That's one of the exceptions to the theorem I was sketching out before about why it did produce efficient law. That's the same problem on the market for law that economists refer to as externalities, which lead to inefficient outcomes in ordinary private markets. And the defense of my system against that problem is the same as my defense of the market in general against that problem, and that is that the alternative is worse. That is to say that the system I have described will sometimes produce less than optimal law, but the political system has no mechanism pushing it to produce optimal law, unless you think that democratic voting with rationally ignorant voters is going to do it. and therefore the problem that is the special case in the market situation is the rule, the normal case in the political situation. And I would say that is true also for things other than law. That is to say that it is true that if farming is private, a farmer will sometimes take an action. He's providing a crop which allows his neighbor who has bees to let the bees browse on the nectar of the blossoms of his alfalfa and produce nice yummy honey. And he can't charge the bees for doing that because bees unfortunately don't recognize human property rights. So therefore he will produce a suboptimal amount of alfalfa. The story's a little more complicated, but again, this is only one talk. But in any case, the point I'm making is there are occasionally externality problems and public good problems within the market system, but the such problems are the normal situation in the political system. Very nearly no political actor bears the costs or receives the benefits of his own action. It's true of a voter, it's true of a politician, it's true of a lobbyist, it's true of a judge. If a judge makes a decision which sets a precedent in our common law system, which makes the country 1/100% poorer, that's a huge amount of damage for one human being to make, billions and billions of dollars worth, and yet he'll never know. He won't. It won't come out of his pocket. I could go on that too. I've got a particular horror story about judges, but I won't bore you with it at the moment. So in any case, let me go on, however, to the future, because I don't expect what I've described to happen in Spain or the US anytime in the next few decades. What I'm trying to do is to say, all right, I believe in free markets. How far can I push that idea? And my answer is I believe I can push it all the way and give a plausible description of a society in which the markets did everything. We may eventually get such a society, but it's not on the immediate horizon. However, I want to claim that we are quite likely to get that in the limited area of cyberspace. How many people here know what public key encryption is? Right. All right. It's maybe the most one of the most important technological breakthroughs of the last 50 years. It's a way in which you can have a world where you can send a message to a stranger such that nobody but the stranger can read it. You can send a message, whether to a stranger or somebody else, and prove that you're the person who sent it if you want to. You can establish a reputation while still being anonymous. That is, you can establish a reputation for your online persona without having to tell anybody irrelevant details, such as what continent you live on, whether you're a man or a woman, a child or an adult, black or white, old or young. So that public key encryption makes possible a world where all communication is private, where nobody knows who pays whom what. You can use the technology to generate an anonymous digital cash, or who is talking to whom. It is very hard to tax or regulate things you cannot see. So that means that we may well move towards a world which is in effect anarchy online. To some extent we already have. Contract enforcement in that world is done by reputation. eBay already does it. eBay has mechanisms such that when you buy from a seller on eBay, you essentially report satisfaction with the transaction. They make that information available to later purchasers. And one can think of fancy and more sophisticated ways, because digital signatures can make it easy for you and me to sign a contract that either of us can prove to anybody else that we both signed. We can sign a contract that specifies an arbitrator, and the arbitrator can then prove that he's the arbitrator we agreed to in the contract. So if we have a contract and a dispute and it goes to the arbitrator and the arbitrator says that I owe you $5,000 and I don't pay it, the arbitrator can then provide you with that information and you can put it up on a web page with my name all over it, and anybody who wants to do business with me will rapidly discover that I'm not to be trusted. All right. So it's a mechanism which makes possible a non-violent but effective form of contract enforcement. So I want to argue that something like market anarchy may develop and to some extent is developing online. All right. Interesting future possibility. I should say I have a book called Future Imperfect, which looks at a whole variety of different technologies that might develop in the next few decades and what the implications would be if they do. Suppose we end up with anarchy in cyberspace and government in real space. And suppose we are in a world where most of the interesting stuff happens online, where most people are telecommuting to work, where most think about a world where virtual reality is a bit better than it is. I don't know if any of you have played have used the relatively new virtual reality goggles, but they're really quite impressive in the sense that you are standing there seeing a world that doesn't exist, moving things in that world and so forth. So suppose we get that technology gets steadily better, and the result is that most of our life is lived online. It is now very easy to move. That is to say, when you move from one country to another, you take your email address and your URL with you. If one government doesn't treat you right, you can vote with your feet to another. Part of what encouraged me in these thoughts is a few years ago, I took a trip that included India. My daughter went along with me. My daughter is a freelance online editor, and she took her work with her. She could do the work she did just as easily in Delhi as she could in San Jose. In that world, governments are just landlords, competitive landlords. All right? So that's at least one way in which you could get something in the direction of what I'm describing within your lifetimes, probably within mine only if we solve the aging problem, which is another subject I've discussed. For much more on all of this stuff, my website is daviddfriedman.com. It contains links to the second edition of The Machinery of Freedom, which is the book where I first sketched the ideas of market anarchy as I have it. That's the second edition is a free PDF. The third edition, as I mentioned, is the $2.99 Kindle on Amazon. There's also an audiobook of it for people who commute somewhere or other and like to listen to things while they're driving or other places where they like audiobooks. I've been making my books into audiobooks because making a book into an audiobook is a whole lot less work than writing another book. My latest nonfiction book is called Legal Systems Very Different from Ours. I don't have an audiobook of it, but somebody else has been reading chapters and recording them and putting them up as podcasts, and if you look, you can find those. And one of the things it describes and discusses are various past societies which I regard as sort of primitive versions of market anarchy. That is, societies where law enforcement was private and decentralized, but society is much less complicated than what I'm describing. Also, a lot of other things. I look at the legal. The basic point of that book is that all human societies face about the same problems. They solve them in an interesting variety of different ways, and they're all grown-ups. So therefore, we should take all of them seriously. That's available as print and Kindle on Amazon. Also, as I mentioned, most of my published articles are on my webpage. There are recordings of many, many, many talks I've given, some of them video recordings, some of them audio recording. At this very moment, my cell phone is doing an audio recording of this talk, and with luck, maybe someone in the audience is doing a video recording, because nowadays, everybody in my audience pretty much has a video camera in his pocket. Also, I have a blog. I should say I'm not very active on the blog at the moment because I discovered someone else's blog, which was really fun to talk to with people on, but the blog has got, I suppose, 15 years or 20 years of my comments on a very wide variety of subjects. So if you want to know what I think about global warming or home unschooling, unschooling means education where you don't have any curriculum. I could give a long diatribe on what is wrong with the standard model of K-12 schooling, but that would have to be another talk. I think that pretty much covers it. Thank you all.
Coronavirus, how will you control anarchy
It's a good question. Obviously, to some extent, you just control it by individuals taking rational action because people don't want to get infected. And to some extent, people care about infecting others. But beyond that, you might not. Let me give you a broader answer to the implicit question. Are there any things that governments do usefully? Yes. The problem is we have no way of constructing a government that only does useful things. There was an academic who, no longer alive, unfortunately, who tried to calculate how many human beings had been killed by their own government in the 20th century. And his figure was about 200 million. His name is Rummel. If you look up democide, which is the term he used for that activity, and Rummel, you can find his stuff online and his calculations. So basically, I think there are things where government is useful. In particular, government provides a way of solving some public good problems. It may well be that dealing with contagious diseases is one of those things. In principle, you could imagine a legal rules where if I catch a disease from you, I can sue you. But it's going to be very hard in practice because I don't know who I caught it from. So I think the answer may well be that a reasonably sensible government will handle a contagious disease better than an anarchy will. But that same government will also lock people up for smoking marijuana and prevent them from importing goods and once in a while get in a war. And if it goes really badly, which probably neither my government nor yours will, kill large numbers of its own citizens.
If there is a conflict between two people and each one of them is attending or is a different firm, and one of them tricks the system.
One of them what?
Tricks the system. Either
tricks.
The firm or the person comes out of the argument with an answer solution. So in both Spain and both the US, there's this system where you can appeal to a higher judge.
I understand.
And he can tell you and tell you. Okay, so this was wrong.
Yep. But this is a little bit like asking me if private markets produce automobiles, will they have front-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive? That the system we're describing could have an appeal system. The private court might find that customers liked it better if there were such a mechanism, or it could not. And that's really going to be a market outcome depending on the costs and benefits as perceived by the customers of such a system.
In which kind of territories would this system be applied, and how do you can avoid people of the territory don't divide it into two sides, one who approves the system and the others who not, and the ones who approve stay in the system and the ones who not can return into the government?
Well. Fortunately, creating a government is the public good problem. That is to say, suppose 40% of the population want a government. Each individual, if he spends his energy and money trying to bring a government, is going to be sharing that benefit from the rest of the 40%, so he doesn't have much incentive to do it. On the other hand, the defense is private agencies which want to protect their customers from being robbed, even if you call it taxation. So it seems to me that once you've got it, obviously if enough people want to restore a government, you will. But I think it's, on the whole, going to be relatively hard to recreate a government in that situation. Incidentally, let me mention, just for your own interest, I don't know how many of you read science fiction, but Werner Vinge, who is a fairly interesting science fiction writer, also a computer scientist, science professor, wrote a short story called The Ungoverned, which is about the invasion of an anarcho-capitalist society by an adjacent state. And it's a fairly interesting and I think entertaining but also interesting story. And at the end of it, he credits my book, Machinery of Freedom, for where he got the idea for the society that was being invaded. Someone else?
What's your opinion on Bitcoin?
Bitcoin, it is a brilliant idea. When I started writing about digital currency, I had no idea that Bitcoin would happen, that the anonymous digital coin that I and some other people were talking about at the time was Chaumian digital currency, which requires a bank that's issuing it, like other forms of currency, and which, however, is fully anonymous. And Bitcoin, of course, is not anonymous. Bitcoin is in some sense the least anonymous money that has ever existed, since every transaction is public information for every user of Bitcoin. Now, that makes it sound worse than it is, because what's public information is what account the money went to and or from, not what person. But I believe it is the case that a bad guy who is watching you carefully for long enough is going to be able to figure out what account matches what person, and therefore it does give you the virtue of a digital currency, but not of an anonymous digital currency, which is what many of us would really like. And the trouble with the Chaumian solution, which is quite a different approach to it, is that in order to do that, you need a bank you trust. Banks you trust are probably going to be in developed countries. If anonymous digital currency exists, money laundering laws become unenforceable. Consequently, almost all developed countries are against having banks that issue anonymous digital currency, and the ones that aren't can be undoubtedly pressured by the ones that are against it into not doing it. And the beauty of Bitcoin is there's no issuer, and therefore with Bitcoin, you don't have to have a bank. So in that sense, it was a very clever idea. Now, as cryptocurrencies go, Bitcoin's pretty obvious disadvantage is that its value is quite unstable. And therefore, although it makes sense for sort of day-to-day transactions, you don't want to hold it for very long unless you want to gamble, which is, it's all right if you want to gamble. And I think that it would be desirable for somebody to come up with a cryptocurrency along the same general lines, which has a stable value in something. It could be a stable value in dollars. It could be a stable value in terms of a bundle of commodities that it was set to. And I think I can describe at least one way one could, there are projects along those lines, but I don't follow them very carefully. But I can describe at least one mechanism by which you could have a set of players, as it were, in each of whose private interest it was to behave in a way that held the value of your of the cryptocurrency constant. Now, there are, I mean, I don't know how much you know about cryptocurrencies, because there are a bunch of different projects. Bitcoin was the first one and is probably still the biggest one. There are a number of projects which are attempting to make them more anonymous. And I was at a conference a year or two ago where I organized a session on anonymous digital currencies. And there were people in that session from both of the projects to create an anonymous digital currency, and they both agreed that it couldn't be done. That you could have a, they could have a digital currency where it was hard to know who was spending what to whom, but that a sufficiently persistent opponent with enough resources could eventually crack it. And that was their opinion then, but I'm not, certainly not an expert on that. But ideally what I would like to see is a fully anonymous digital currency, cryptocurrency, which has reasonably predictable value in the future.
What would happen if a rich man wants to buy a convict as a slave?
Wants to buy?
A convict, like
Well, again, that depends what the legal rules are produced by that system. You know, I don't know, does Spain still have the draft? Are you all potential slaves?
No.
Well, good. But I think the answer is that you could certainly imagine a legal system where if the court says you did something wrong for which you owe $100,000 damages, and you can't pay $100,000, so you're going to have to be an indentured servant for 10 years. That's a real-world set of institutions. That is, as you may know, in British law in the 18th century, if you were convicted of a so-called non-clergyable felony, which on paper was a capital offense, what was actually quite likely to happen was that the judge would say, I will pardon you if you agree to transportation. And what did transportation mean? It meant that you would be transported to the New World and would be sold as an indentured servant for 14 years. So that was a real-world legal system which did that. It's not clear if it was a good or bad thing, given the alternatives. A different case, which was entirely voluntary, is that in the 18th century, one way in which a substantial number of people migrated to the U.S. was by selling themselves. That essentially, you had people who wanted to come to the U.S. and didn't have enough money to pay for what was then quite an expensive trip. So they would make a deal with a ship captain, And the deal was the ship captain would transport them for $100 or whatever the cost was. When they arrived, he would auction their services off. And it was a reverse auction, that the person who won the auction was the person who was willing to pay the $100 in exchange for the shortest period of service. And they would then be indentured servants, essentially temporary slaves for that length of time. And for that matter, in saga period Iceland 1,000 years ago, which is a legal system that I long ago came across and found very interesting, one possible result of a court concluding that you owed, that you say you had killed somebody and you owed 200 ounces of silver as wehrgeld for it, as the money owed to his surviving kin, you couldn't pay it, and one option was to become a debt thrall, to become a temporary slave while you worked it off. So I can't say that wouldn't happen in this system. Now, in a relatively wealthy society like ours, I don't think it's very likely, but if you imagine a society where people cared a lot about preventing crime, and a lot of the criminals, well, you could execute them, but better to be a slave than be killed, that you could end up with that situation.
Ultimo, alguien o nadie?
Yeah, so one of the biggest examples right now of anarchy is international society, where even though we have like an international court of justice and all these institutions, states don't recognize their authority.
Yes.
So we don't have, they go unpunished. In a way. So could this happen in an anarcho-capitalism? Like, how could I demand something from someone who has injured my right if he doesn't recognize the authority of the people who punish him? Like, could it happen that crimes go unpunished in this?
It certainly can happen. It does now. You don't always catch the criminal. But I think it is unlikely that you would have people who did not sign on to the system, because the cost of not signing on to the system is that when somebody thinks you've committed a crime against him, you've got nobody on your side to defend you, and you have no pre-existing mechanism to get it arbitrated. And that sounds like an unattractive situation. But I should say that in the Vinge short story, there is somebody who is what they call an armadillo, who was somebody who pulled out of the system, basically fortified his own farm, and had almost nothing to do with his neighbors. And that turned out to be an important element in the story, as the story worked out. Because the invading army ends up reaching his farm, and they treat it as a fortress of the enemy country. Because part of the fun of the Vinge story is that the people on each side are interpreting the other in their terms. So the invading army thinks that the anarchy calls itself an anarchy, but really, you know, and so forth. And it's quite a lot of fun. That's a digression.